Check, check, mic check.
Mic check, mic check.
Welcome to Making Sense of Wealth with Andrew Whalen, your personal CFO. The show where we break down complex financial topics and market events into investor-friendly concepts so that you can make better informed decisions about your financial future. Because if it don't make dollars, it don't make sense.
Welcome to an episode of Making Sense of Wealth. My name is Andrew Whalen, your host, your personal CFO. I'm happy to be here today. What we wanted to do was we hosted a conference call for our client base, one to inform them. We worked with Goldman Sachs Investment Research as far as to get the basic information of what they're trying to generalize to the public. This includes information on basically the pandemic itself, the areas that they're using to address this pandemic, the economic implications, as well as investment implications. So we wanted to take a time to share that conference call with you. So without further ado, we're going to jump right into that. Good morning, everybody. I hope you're doing well. Thanks for taking the time today. I hope everyone's safe and at home. Before we get started, I have to cover a couple legal disclosures just for compliance, that the opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individuals. All performance referenced in historical is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. All investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Rebalancing a portfolio may cause investors to incur tax liabilities or transaction costs. No strategy assures success or protects against loss. Options are not suitable for all investors, and certain option strategies may expose investors to significant potential losses, such as lost entire amount paid in the option. You should discuss your specific situation with your advisor prior to investing. Whew, got that out of the way. So like I said, thanks for joining me. It's kind of eerie here. I know the majority of you have been to our office before. Literally, there's only our cars in the parking lot. We're the only ones here. We are deemed an essential business here in the state of Nevada because we are a financial institution. So we're going to go into kind of where Whalen Financial sees the current pandemic, the virus COVID-19, and go into detail because we talk to, on a daily basis, a lot of investment managers. And we want to be able to convey some of those messages that we hear from our managers to our clients. And hosting a client-wide conference call is usually the easiest way to do that, specifically in these times. But before I begin, everybody's on mute. We won't be answering any specific questions, but at the end of the conference call, if you have any specific questions, please give the office a call at 702-878-3900. So without further ado, let's get started. So, you know, what a difference a day makes. In less than a month, you know, we shifted from explaining why the U.S. economy and the bull market had room to grow to how much the global economy, equity markets, interest rates, and oil prices could fall. You know, the purpose of this call is to provide a synopsis of our views and those of the individuals in our professional network that we've had calls over the last 6 weeks with. We begin with a summary of issues discussed with infectious and biodefense specialist Dr. Barry Bloom of Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and formerly head of the school, as well as Dr. Lucinio Borio of NQTEL and former Director of Medical and Biodefense Preparedness at the National Security Council and Acting Chief Scientist of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We will also then provide historical context of this pandemic relative to other viral epidemics. We then turn to likely economic impacts of COVID-19 pandemic, including the views of Goldman Sachs Global Investment Research, which is known as GIR, and the colleagues on the likelihood of a recession. And then finally, we'll conclude with our views on the investment implications themselves. So the fear of the unknown, SARS-CoV-2 and its disease COVID-19. What we want to emphasize here is the enormous uncertainty surrounding the virus at this time. Our infectious disease specialists have warned and continue to warn that it's too early to know the fatality rate, the incubation period and reproduction number, and contagious period. Therefore, as you hear estimates of how many people will contract the disease in the U.S. and Europe, and how many people will die as a result, please keep in mind that nobody knows. So as Dr. Bloom said on our call, one has to take any specific number, like the mortality rates, with a grain of salt. Widely quoted Harvard epidemiologist Mark Lipstick initially projected that 40 to 70% of the human population could potentially be infected by the virus if it becomes a pandemic. He later qualified that statement to apply only to adults since children seem to be less affected. The number was further revised down to 20 to 60%. He also stated that measures from self-quarantining to social distancing will affect these estimates. You know, as we look at the data from China, it shows the extent to which the effective policy can produce a completely different set of numbers. If we were to use the current reported rate of growth in the number of infections through early May, the number of infected people in China may peak at around 100,000. Given a population of 1.4 billion people, the infection rate would be 0.007%. The number of new cases in Wuhan could potentially fall to zero, as we've seen them starting to taper off. And what they contribute this low rate to number of policy measures, starting with social distancing, extensive testing, centralized quarantine, lockdown of Wuhan, and a traffic ban. Now, it's obvious that the government policy has a significant impact on the relevant numbers. So what are the relevant numbers? First, let's address the fatality rate. The fatality rate is the number of people who have died from the disease divided by the number of infected. Obviously, no one knows the number of infected people in every country at this time, so the fatality rate may well be overstated because we are measuring a known number by an estimate of the number of infected people. There's also significant dispersion in the fatality rate between age groups and regions. The fatality rate among 40 to 49-year-olds in China is 0.44% compared to 14.77% in Chinese over 80. The fatality rate in Wuhan, the epicenter of the virus, is estimated at 4.87% compared to 0.88% in the mainland China outside of Hubei. In Italy, the estimate is 6.81 compared to 0.92 in South Korea. The other relevant number is what's known as the incubation period. Here again, there is some uncertainty. WHO, or the World Health Organization, estimates a 2 to 7 day window where a person may have become infected before they show symptoms. The US CDC estimates 2 to 14 day incubation period. Earlier in the epidemic, one Chinese study indicated it could be as long as 24 days. The reproduction number, or what we call the R-naught. The reproduction number is the number of people every infected person infects. Originally, this number was estimated 2 to 4 people. It has been lowered to 2 to 3. However, this is an extremely rough estimate because there is uncertainty about the contagious period. Dr. Bloom has said that the epidemic will be under control when R-naught equals 1 or less. The path of R-naught in Wuhan is an example of how quickly the epidemic was brought under control by reducing the reproduction rate from 3.88 in mid-January to 0.32 by mid-February. The last relevant number is the contagious period. This period is the amount of time someone is contagious, and there are no estimates at this time. The recent data from New Rochelle, New York, confirms that individuals have tested positive who have no symptoms. The individuals that we've spoken to in the medical community have highlighted that infected individuals seem to shed a lot of the virus 2 days before the symptoms appear. The World Health Organization has noted that some patients can shed the virus 24 to 48 hours before the onset of symptoms, which means people are highly contagious and can easily spread the virus without knowing they are sick and before they quarantine themselves. Finally, some people who have recovered in China still had detectable viruses in their respiratory tract. So such uncertainty has created a tremendous fear of the unknown. The virus is a new pathogen, hence all the uncertainty about its characteristics. It is highly transmissible, even before someone has visible symptoms. We do not have any immunity given that this is a new pathogen. Diagnosis in the U.S. has been poor because of the shortcomings of diagnostic tests. There is no therapeutic drug yet, and there is no vaccine yet. To allay such fears, the healthcare system has to address 3 issues. The first issue is proper diagnostics. Fear has been compounded by the fact that we do not know how widespread the disease is in the U.S. since the U.S. healthcare system does not have enough functioning test kits. Both Dr. Bloom and Dr. Borio expressed significant concern about this shortcoming. Problems have ranged from faulty test kits to shortages of RNA extraction kits. Last Thursday, on March 12th, at the congressional hearing, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, stated that the U.S. testing system is, quote, not really geared to what we need right now. That is a failing. Let's admit it. Dr. Borio has referred to the shortage as one of the most dramatic failures in our early public health response that she can think of. However, several manufacturers have now undertaken the task of ramping up production of the testing kits, and the president has committed that his administration would work with the private sector to provide the drive-through testing widely available in South Korea. Slowly but surely, the issues of diagnostics will be addressed. In the meantime, it is important to be prepared for a substantial increase in the number of infections. As highlighted by some of our individuals that we've spoken to in the health community, the numbers are certainly in the thousands. We should keep in mind that increased testing likely means that some portion of this expected increase represents the identification of cases that are already existed instead of newly acquired infections. Number two, therapeutics. While therapy is not yet available, the experts that we talked to have expressed some optimism that a therapy to treat infected patients could be forthcoming in the next several months. The CEO of Gilead Sciences has stated that he expects the results of clinical trials of their drug to be available potentially by April. Regeneron is evaluating a new drug for rheumatoid arthritis since it has been effective with patients in China and Italy. One of the world's most prestigious medical journals has just published an article on a different kind of plasma and immunoglobulins as a potential therapy of COVID-19 patients. Such therapy was used as the last resort to improve the survival rate of patients with SARS. Number three is the vaccines. While the general consensus is that vaccines will not be available for the next 1 to 2 years, some of the experts we spoke to were moderately more optimistic, referring to work of several companies supported by CEPI, which is the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. CEPI has launched 4 programs to develop vaccines against COVID-19, working with Inivio, the University of Queensland, Moderna, and CureVac. These programs will leverage a rapid response platform that is already supported by CEPI. The aim is to advance vaccine candidates into clinical testing as soon as possible. Moderna has already delivered a vaccine candidate to the National Institute of Health for clinical testing, and CureVac has suggested developing a vaccine ready for clinical testing in a few months. The expectation is that scientific and medical community will have a sense of the safety and potential immunogenicity of the vaccines against COVID-19 by the summer, and then move to a more advanced efficiency studies with data available towards the end of the year. As medical progress is made in diagnostics, as well as in the next few weeks, therapy in the next few months, and vaccines starting in the summer with more extensive efficiency studies by year end, fear will inevitably abate. At this point, however, as emphasized by Dr. Borio, the most important factor is to mitigate the growth of the pandemic curve through the various social distancing measures. The growth curve has to be flattened to prevent strains on the healthcare system and to buy time for therapies and vaccines to be developed. So what I want to do is just briefly examine the data of past viral epidemics to provide some context to this pandemic. While this viral pandemic is different than past epidemics or pandemics and is not an influenza virus like H1N1, we still believe that it is helpful to have some context for the numbers of cases and the fatality rate. The H1N1 pandemic was quite significant in the terms of number of people affected, but the mortality rate was very low. 60 million people were infected and over 12,000 people died in the United States. The impact was overshadowed by the global financial crisis, but the scare was not insignificant. As we looked at different magazine articles from Time to Newsweek, where they did cover the H1N1 and how bad it was. About 36 to 51 million Americans have been infected by the seasonal flu so far this year through early March, and the U.S. CDC estimated 22 to 55,000 deaths have occurred. Of course, the seasonal flu does not create such panic, partly due to the low case fatality rate. However, the absolute number of deaths is still quite staggering. We should note that comparisons to the Spanish flu of 1918 in terms of number of infections and deaths are grossly exaggerated. 1/3 of the world's population was infected, and the case fatality rate was 10%, equivalent to over 200 million people today. As Dr. Bloom pointed out to us, in 1918, the world did not have ventilators, a lot of healthcare facilities, or epidemiologists at the time. Moreover, many of the fatalities were actually caused by bacterial infections in the lungs, not the virus itself. Today, those complications could be treated with antibiotics, which did not exist then. While such exaggerations have the benefit of spurring governments and societies into action, no one actually expects those levels of infections or fatalities. The key lesson from the Spanish flu is that the U.S. cities, which imposed non-pharmaceutical interventions such as social distancing and banning large gatherings in the epidemic and maintained their interventions over a long period of time, had fewer total cases of pandemic influenza than those which waited. So I'm going to move on now to external shocks. As Larry Summers, from the former Secretary of the Treasury and President Emeritus of Harvard, wrote in early March, COVID-19 is one of the most dangerous and disruptive disease outbreaks since World War I. However, it is important to keep in mind that this is not the first time the United States has been hit with an external shock that has grounded many parts of its economy to a halt. Let's all think back to September 11th. The Department of Transportation closed the national airspace system for 2 days. The New York Stock Exchange was closed for 4 days. Downtown Manhattan was closed for several days, and ready access was limited for over a month. Fears of further terrorist attacks were exacerbated by the delivery of anthrax, a deadly toxin, to recipients in Washington, D.C., West Palm Beach, and New York City starting on September 18th. 22 people were infected and 5 died. Across the country, Americans became concerned about biological, chemical, and nuclear attacks, worrying about the security of the water supply and the safety of trains, airplanes, bridges, and tunnels. Water purifiers and gas masks were flying off the shelves. Some people working in high-rise offices bought low-altitude parachutes in case another airplane struck a building. During that external shock, nearly 3,000 Americans were killed. Yet the financial markets have reached much more negativity to COVID-19 than to 9/11. We look at the airline sector since it is one sector most affected by both shocks. Of course, we understand that the world is more interconnected, supply chains are more complex across different countries, and China is a critical link in the global supply chain. However, as the pandemic has started to abate in China, the financial markets have shrugged off the improvement. If you look back from peak to trough declines, comparing 9/11 to COVID-19 outbreaks for the airline industry, the airline industry was down 32% from peak to trough in September 11th timeframe. Today, COVID-19 has caused airline stocks to drop, on average, 46%. Therefore, the key question is whether COVID-19 is the external shock that will throw the U.S., China, and other regions and large countries, such as the Eurozone and Japan, into a deep and prolonged recession that will be substantially worse than 9/11 terrorist attack shock, or is there a greater fear of the unknown that is driving the current markets? We're going to move now on to the economic slowdown or a deep and prolonged recession. So first, let's examine China, because we can actually see the data and the facts coming in from that region as well as South Korea. The uncertainty with respect to this virus extends to the uncertainty with respect to the depth and length of the recession. We begin with the epicenter of the pandemic by looking at China. China's impact on global growth is fourfold. First, direct impact of slower growth in China. Two, spillover to other countries from reduced good imports. Three, spillover to other countries from reduced spending by Chinese tourists. For example, Chinese tourists account for nearly 1/3 of all tourists in Japan. Number four, disruption to supply chains relying on Chinese parts. Dun & Bradstreet estimates that 16.3% of Fortune 100 companies have tier one suppliers that supply parts directly into the U.S. manufacturing process, and 93.8% have Tier 2 suppliers that supply parts to Tier 1 suppliers, all based in affect areas of China. The aggressive measures taken in China to slow down the rate of COVID-19 infections has been successful, but they also led to a significant decrease in economic activity. Goldman Sachs head of research development and Asia-Pacific economist, daily indicators of economic activity such as coal consumption, passenger volume, and property transactions were about 70 to 80% below their 2019 levels immediately after the Lunar New Year. At the current rate of improvement of 5 to 10% per week, he estimates that China should reach normal levels of capacity utilization by sometime in April. The slower pace of normalization is driven by several constraints, including shortages of labor, as migrant workers have yet to return to their place of work, and companies not having the required equipment, such as masks. The Asia team estimates that the first quarter GDP will probably drop by about 6% in China, given a double-digit decrease in the measures of economic activity and only a gradual pace of recovery in March. They expect aggressive monetary and fiscal policy measures to provide a floor to the slowdown. Policy response measures could include stimulating the economy by lowering interest rates. An additional boost to China's growth has been the substantial drop in oil prices, exacerbated by the recent Saudi Arabia and Russia oil price war, and the cumulative drop in oil prices of about 50% since the beginning of 2020. Next, I'd like to move on to the United States. Estimates of U.S. growth have also been downgraded since the emergence of COVID-19. The head of global research and chief economist for Goldman Sachs has downgraded his overall 2020 growth target from 2.3 to 2.1 in February after incorporating the impact of growth slowdown in supply chains in China. It was further then revised down to 1.3 in early March and 1.2% a week later. As the epidemic in China grew to a global pandemic, the growth forecast had been revised further to 0.4% for 2020, comprised of annualized real GDP growth rate of 0% in Q1, negative 5% in Q2, positive 3% in Q3, and positive 4% in Q4. While they have not formally called for a recession, he thinks that it is a high probability that Business Cycle Dating Committee would classify the new forecast as a recession. An annualized drop of 5%, which is an actual decrease of 1.2%, may be deep enough even if it's short-lived. The same factors that flatten the growth curve of this pandemic in the U.S. are the same factors that will push the economy to drop in GDP, although we still believe that that will be temporarily. As in the case in China, monetary policy and fiscal policy are key to minimizing further downside to this scenario. The Federal Reserve has cut the federal funds rate to basically zero and launched a new round of quantitative easing, purchasing at least $700 billion of U.S. treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. The Federal Reserve has paved a way for other policymakers to provide necessary fiscal stimulus, which comes from Congress. As suggested by Henry Paulson, which is the former Secretary of the Treasury and former CEO of Goldman Sachs, in a recent opinion article in the Washington Post, targeted fiscal stimulus to address areas most hit by COVID-19 are critical. Some may recall his reference to a powerful bazooka in July 2008. While the specifics of current proposals from the House as well as the Senate are being finalized, this package is considered one of several upcoming measures to stimulate the economy. They expect fiscal stimulus between 1 to 2% of GDP in both 2020 and 2021, with more front-loading of the stimulus in 2020. Another indication of what we saw in the markets, which we thought was really interesting, was more so of the drop in oil prices than the COVID-19 virus. And it seems that when it rains, it pours. Just as we are getting some respite from the diminished tensions of the U.S.-China trade war, two of the three largest oil producers have engaged in oil price war. When Russia announced on March 6 that it would no longer participate in further supply cuts after the expiry of current oil production quotas on April 1st, Saudi Arabia responded quickly and aggressively, It offered meaningful discounts to prevailing prices and announced plans to increase production from 9.7 million barrels per day to a target 12.3 million barrels per day. Oil prices and energy-related stocks, which had already been on a decline since early January, nosedived lower. Oil experienced its largest one-day drop, with both West Texas Intermediate and Brent falling 23% and energy stocks declining 20%, bringing the cumulative drop in oil and energy stocks to about 50%. This drop will be helpful to net oil importers like China, Japan, and Europe. The benefits of lower oil prices for the consumer and the airline industry are mostly offset by the hit to the energy sector, especially the shale oil producers. If Russia or Saudi Arabia's goal was to eliminate the U.S. shale industry and reverse that increase in the U.S. market share, the goal is unlikely to be realized, since the industry as a whole has shown great resiliency, as seen in 2014 during the last oil drop epidemic. So we've covered, you know, some professional opinions on the COVID-19 virus. We've discussed how it's going to affect the economy, at least in the short term. Now let's move on to the investment implications. We were surprised that the S&P 500 had rallied about 5% from its low after its first moderate drop of 3% after the first case of COVID-19 was reported in Washington State on January 17th. But we were equally surprised by the speed and the magnitude of the 27% peak-to-trough decline. In fact, this was the fastest decline of 25% from an all-time high in history. In our view, the market decline is pricing a 90% probability of a recession. The question posed by clients is, why do we continue to suggest remaining invested rather than going underweight or selling equities, especially in light of lower U.S. and global growth estimates, lower projected earnings per share, and lower interim price targets of 2,000 for the S&P 500 put out by Goldman Sachs earlier this week. We did also note in our State of the Markets address that we wrote the external shocks were one of the three factors that have historically led to a recession. COVID-19 is certainly a shock. There are several reasons why we have not recommended underweighting or selling equities. First and most importantly, while we were surprised that the market was rallying to new highs in the face of deteriorating news of the virus in early February, we have been more surprised by the rapid and force with which it has fallen in recent weeks, especially since none of the traditional recession indicators we follow have yet to trigger. But given that decline, we think a typical recession with a peak-to-trough decline of 30% has already been discounted by the market. Second, the level of volatility in this market has approached levels last seen near the trough of the global financial crisis. Because such extremes typically reflect persuasive fear among market participants, they have represented better buying opportunities than sell signals historically. Of equal importance, high volatility coupled with today's poor liquidity increases the risk of our clients getting whipsawed by the markets. Consider that the S&P 500's 9.3% gain last Friday, March 13th, was the best day since October 2008, while the 9.5% loss the day before was the worst day since Black Monday in 1987. When the market is generating a typical year's worth of gains or losses in a single day, the penalty of trading missteps is exacerbated and extremely high. Third, the experience of several Asian countries with social distancing, frequent testing, and tracing of infected persons' contacts shows that there is a template for bringing the spread of the virus under control. As a result, we believe that the current level of the panic may be unwarranted. It is hard to imagine this shock is significantly worse than that of September 11 terrorist attacks when we consider the extreme fear pervading the residents of most large metropolitan areas in the U.S. at that time. Fourth, we believe that significant easing of monetary policy from the Federal Reserve and strong fiscal stimulus will provide a floor to the depth of any economic contraction. Given such contractions are often born of major financial and economic imbalances, it is notable that the U.S. economy entered this downturn more balanced than its average level based on the data since 1990. At the same time, the private sector financial balance, as measured by savings of households and corporations, is strong by historical standards and thus better able to absorb this shock. While it is impossible to predict a shock by definition, we had raised the prospects of geopolitical tensions between the U.S. and Iran as a likely source of volatility, but believed that the U.S. economy would be able to weather that type of shock. Fifth, we share the optimism of various vaccine experts and researchers at biotech companies based on the good progress that has been made on various therapies and vaccines so far. We believe that fear will abate at the first significant evidence of such progress. Six, while the analyst we follow has steadily marked down his interim targets as the impact of social distancing and travel bans on earnings of various industries becomes more apparent, the year-end target is actually only slightly below the previous target, and it suggests a significant rally from current levels. With regards to the potential interim downside and the year-end target, the market could potentially fall to an S&P 500 level of 2,000, which is about a 14 or 15% drop from here. But the year-end target remains to be at 3,200. Here we are reminded from a quote on March 16, 2009, which turned out to be near the trough of the financial crisis, although we did not know it at the time. The quote below was from Seth Klarman, one of the most highly respected investors in the financial industry. He said, and I quote, "To maintain a truly long-term view, investors must be willing to experience significant short-term losses. Without the possibility of near-term pain, there can be no long-term gain. The ability to remain an investor and not become a day trader or a bystander confers an almost unprecedented advantage in this environment. Trying to trade a possible downside target when the year-end target is substantially higher is appropriate for day traders, momentum followers, and some hedge fund managers, but not for long-term investors. Of equal importance, there is no guarantee that the market reaches the lower levels that may be used as justification for selling today. On the other hand, we are more confident that the market will eventually reach the higher target given the resiliency of the U.S. economy. And finally, we actually think that current levels provide an opportunity to slowly add to the risk levels of a portfolio. For those of who have been sitting on excess cash and have staying power with the right strategic asset allocation, this is the time to start incrementally adding to the S&P 500 equities. I know it can be difficult to keep looking forward with so much uncertainty and so many unanswered questions right now. But for long-term investors, it is important to maintain a clear vision of financial goals and the plan for getting there. Market volatility, like we're experiencing now, may provide pockets of opportunity for suitable portfolios. As a recession increasingly is priced into the market, stock market valuations relative to their earnings power and to bond yields have become more attractive. Current uncertainty means taking a careful, measured approach, but for appropriate investors, there may be even small ways to consider taking advantage of these potential opportunities. It is likely that we see an economic rebound later this year and into 2021 as the outbreak is contained, businesses reopen, and fiscal and monetary policy support expands. The U.S. economy and corporate America have steered their way through world wars, cold wars, financial crises, and geopolitical events. Through even the most challenging times, markets have found their way back to normalcy, and investors have been able to look to the future. There's no reason to believe this time will be any different. Trust your plan, be well, and make sure to contact us if you have any questions or concerns. I want to thank everybody for taking the time out of their day today. The most important thing is to remain safe. Don't take any excess risks. We will be continuously hosting conference calls and portfolio reviews over the phone and also over Zoom video conference for those clients that are outside the state of Nevada. If you have any questions, please reach out to me. I hope I was able to inform you, keep you updated, and provide a little bit of optimism in a time where a country needs it the most. Have a nice day. Talk to you soon.
Securities and advisory services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA, SIPC. This material is for general information only and is not intended to provide specific advice and recommendation for any individuals. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. No strategy assures success or protects against loss.